Jai Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Kopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari Jashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana Jashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivara Dhari Jashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana Jashoda Nandana Vraja Janaranjana Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Vishnuvad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotara Satasi Simad Isi Bhakti Vedant Saman Prabhupada Ki Jai Iskand Founder Acharya Sira Prabhupada Ki Jai Jaya Vishnuvad Paramahamsa Parivrajaka Acharya Stotara Satasi Simad Bhakti Sanat Saraswati Thakur Ki Jai Nandagodi Vaishnavarinda Ki Jai Namacharya Sira Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Prem Sekahu Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Siddhaita Gadadhar Sivasadi Gaur Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gopinatha Shyam Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Swami Ki Jai Gangamayi Ki Jai Jamunamayi Ki Jai Tulasi Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Samaveta Bhaktivinoda Ki Jai Gaur Prema Nandi Hari Hari Bol. So, Srila Prabhupada's presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate
vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
So, two short announcements before we begin. I received a request today by email from a young granddaughter of one of my disciples in Brazil. Wanted me to wave and say hello during the class in Brazil. So, Oi, Bumi, tudo bem? Hare Krishna. Second thing is that, as you know, Druta Karma and Siddhaputta published some books about science and the way of interpreting scientific data and so on. And I think one of the main points in those books, I mention this because I heard something today on the NPR radio, which is very interesting. One of the main points in the book, as far as I can see, is that there's a knowledge filter operating not only among scientists, but actually among all kinds of communities of human beings, so that people have certain things they assume to be true, and if something they confront an apparent fact which contradicts what they believe to be true, they simply filter out that contradictory so-called fact or explain it in a different way so that there's no conflict in their mind. Isn't that, that's correct, isn't it? So on NPR this morning, they had some news that somewhere, I sort of came in late, but they found some tracks, some human-like tracks that are over a million years ago. Then they interviewed this archaeologist that found it, and he simply said, well, since human beings have only been on the earth for, let's say, maybe less than 200,000 years, so that could not be a human track. I mean, it is a human track, but since it goes against what we, what we believe to be true, it must have been created by some miners that came later. And that was the end of it. There was no consideration of any. There's no consideration of anything. There's no consideration of the fact. It was just filtered out, and the announcer, who was supposed to be intelligent, didn't question that. That's just the way it is. If the theory is human beings have only been around this long, then obviously, even though we found this, we really didn't find it. We must have found something else. So, of course, you know that goes on constantly, doesn't it?
Yes, I'm aware of that particular case.
But if we actually see the world is miserable, not only in the sense of birth, death, old age, and disease, which are miserable. For those of you who are getting older, you should tell us what it feels like. So, it's not only miserable in that sense, but it's also miserable in the sense that there's so much gross ignorance in this world. There's very little true objectivity or fairness. There's very little intellectual fairness in the world. After all, this is a world of conditioned souls, and in Kali Yuga, it's a world of heavily conditioned souls. And the more conditioned one is, the more one manipulates and filters and creates so-called facts according to one's conditioning. It's the age of consumerism, and so it's also the age of consumer knowledge, so that people sort of shop for knowledge. And generally they purchase a knowledge which makes them feel good about themselves. It used to be, in the old days, that the best way to feel good about yourself is to be a good person. So if you're a good person, you'll probably feel good about yourself. And actually, that's what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Sattvat Sanjayate Sukham, from goodness comes happiness. But now, there's a much more efficient way. You don't have to actually go to all the trouble and take all the time to become a good person. You can just read some book about how to feel good about yourself, because no matter how bad you are, no matter how bad you appear to be, there's really a good person within. And so you can just connect to that good person, continue your lousy behavior on the outside, and then feel good about yourself. without having to go to all the trouble of actually behaving properly. So it's a very bizarre age we live in. There's something almost comforting about the fact that our bodies are temporary. So anyway, Kali Yuga. So now we're going to chant this verse. This is a paraphernalia verse, as you will see when we translate it. This verse is describing all kinds of paraphernalia that one should use to worship the Lord. Actually, I'm going to do a slight change up here. We'll chant this verse, but then I actually want to go back to the previous purport, the one before this. Well, it's connected. This is not going to be a change up. This is actually all connected, because in order to understand this verse, you have to refer back to Prabhupada's purport in the previous verse. So I won't keep you longer in suspense. We'll dig into this. So, Salilai, Suchibir, Malyar, Panyar, Mula, Pala, Adibi, Shashta, Ankura, Angshukais, Cha, Archet, Tulasya, Priyaya, Prabhu. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to read this one time to save time, because I know that there are time limits here. So I'm just going to chant this once and then go on to the translation so we can get into the philosophy. Salilai Suchibir Malyar Vanyar Mula Valadibi Shastang Kurang Shukai Charche. You did pretty good on that tongue twister. Tulasya Priyaya Prabhu. So this is the translation. One should worship the Lord by offering pure water, pure flower garlands, fruits, flowers, and vegetables available in the forest, or by collecting newly grown grasses, small buds of flowers, even the skins of trees, and if possible, by offering tulasi leaves, which are very dear to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Prabhupada's purport, it is specifically mentioned herein that tulasi leaves are very dear to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and devotees should take particular care to have tulsi leaves in every temple and center of worship. In the Western countries, while engaged in propagating the Krishna consciousness movement, we were brought great unhappiness because we could not find tulsi leaves. We are very much obliged, therefore, to our disciple Srimati Govindadasi, immortalized here in Prabhupada's books, because she has taken much care to grow tulsi plants from seeds, and she has been successful by the grace of Krishna. Now tulsi plants are growing in almost every center of our movement. Tulsi leaves are very important in the method of worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In this verse, the word Salilai means, quote, by the water. Of course, Dhruva Maharaj was worshiping on the bank of the Jamuna. The Jamuna and the Ganges are sacred, and sometimes devotees in India insist that the deity must be worshipped with water of the Ganges or Jamuna. But here we understand Deshakala, which is Prabhupada's quoting from the previous verse, to mean according to time and country. In Western countries, there is no river Jamuna or Ganges. Water from such sacred rivers is not available. Does this mean that the archa worship should, for that reason, be stopped? No. Salilai refers to any water, whatever is available, but it must be very clear and collected purely. That water can be used. The other paraphernalia, such as flower garlands, fruits, and vegetables, should be collected according to the country and according to their availability. Tulsi leaves are very important for satisfying the Lord. So as far as possible, an arrangement should be made for growing tulsi leaves. Dhruva Maharaj was advised to worship the Lord with the fruits and flowers available in the forest. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna frankly says that he accepts vegetables, fruits, flowers, etc. One should not offer Lord Vasudev anything other than what is prescribed herein by the great authority Narada Muni. In other words, Prabhupada's talking here about meat. Narada Muni, one cannot offer to the deity according to one's whims, since these fruits and vegetables are available anywhere in the universe. We should observe this small point very attentively. So, Prabhupada Ki Jai. This verse, what Prabhupada's doing a few things here. First of all, he's extending in context, and it's very proper to do so, the last line of the previous verse to this verse. And that is, actually the last two lines, Narada told Dhruva Maharaj, Saparayang vibhi dhaya dravyaya desha kalavi bhagavit. Well, actually, let's go farther back. In that text 54, first Narada Muni told Dhruva that you should perform worship, first of all, with a mantra. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. With this mantra, mantrena anena, with this mantra, devasya saparyam kuryat. One should perform worship of God. Now, the worship in the previous verse is described as dravyamayin. A Buddha, an intelligent person, should perform worship of God, and that worship, that saparyam, that worship, that intimate worship, is dravyamayin. It consists of dravya, actual physical paraphernalia. Now, this is interesting because in contrast to this dravyamayin saparyam, this worship with physical paraphernalia, there is another kind of worship described in the Bhagavad Gita, in the chapter 4, and also in many other Vedic literatures. That is where the external paraphernalia is internalized. In chapter 4, Krishna says that one may offer, for example, the oblation or the ghee of the senses into the fire of the controlled mind. Now, fire is an actual physical object. And the havis, the ghee, which is offered to the fire, is a physical object. But in chapter 4 of the Gita, Krishna gives a series of examples of internalized worship, where the ghee is not literally a physical object, but symbolic of anything which you offer, and the fire, the agni, from which we get the English word ignite, the agni is also symbolic, and the fire can be not the physical fire, it can be the controlled mind. You can offer the ghee of sense objects into the fire of the senses, and so on and so forth. Krishna is really just, this is not an exhaustive list, these are examples of the types of internalized worship. So, in contrast to that, here, Lord Krishna is explicitly talking about worship with real physical objects. And he gives a list of them in this verse. Most of this verse is just a list of such objects. Now, there's something interesting here. In text 54, this is Canto 4, text, chapter 8, Krishna says that an intelligent person should perform worship of God. What? Oh, Narada. Oh, did I say Dhruva? Krishna. Oh, my God, the first mistake I've ever made. Yes, Narada Muni says that once an intelligent person should perform worship of God, and that worship should be dravya. The word dravya means physical object or paraphernalia. Dravya mayin, consisting of dravya. Now, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna uses that word dravya in a different way. Krishna says, in the Gita, I believe, again, chapter 4, Shreyan dravya maya yagya jnana yagya parantapa, better than the dravya yagya, better than the sacrifice of material paraphernalia, is the sacrifice of knowledge. Sarvam karmakilang partha jnane parisamapyate. Because all prescribed duties or rituals or whatever culminate in knowledge. So there we have Krishna in Bhagavad Gita saying that better than the sacrifice of dravya, material paraphernalia, such as ghee, fire, water, handkerchief, flour, and all the stuff mentioned in this verse, better than that sacrifice is the sacrifice of knowledge, where you actually cultivate knowledge. And yet here, Narada Muni, a pure devotee of Krishna, is saying that an intelligent person should perform this sacrifice consisting of material paraphernalia. This is not a contradiction. It is a paradox, though. A paradox, dox, means thought, actually, in Greek. And paradox, it means two different thoughts at the same time, which are apparently contradictory, but which ultimately are not. At some deeper level, it's the same thing. If we take the verse of the Gita, then the conclusion would be that even though an intelligent person should perform the sacrifice with material paraphernalia, ultimately the goal is knowledge. The goal is to come to Krishna consciousness. Therefore, Prabhupada put the word consciousness in the name of our society, ISKCON. The con is consciousness. And also, this process is Krishna consciousness. So even though the goal is knowledge, ultimately we want to come to the right state of consciousness, we still should continue to offer material things to Krishna. Because after all, we have to eat. If we don't offer anything, how can we eat or drink anything? And so on. But Narada Muni says that the material paraphernalia that we offer must be desha, it should be offered by a person who is desha kalavi bhaga vit. Vit, English, wit, same word. One who knows. One who knows vibhaga, the differences, the distinctions, the divisions of desh and kala, time and place. And in his purport, Prabhupada makes some very heavy statements. He says, the method of worship, chanting the mantra and preparing the forms of the Lord, is not stereotyped. Therefore, we have a deity worship handbook. Nor is it exactly the same everywhere. Nor is it exactly the same everywhere. And we know that. If you go to different Hare Krishna temples, they all have their own styles. Of course, there are boundaries. There are, you know, reasonable boundaries. You can't do anything. But still, every temple, in a sense, has their own unique worship. It is specifically mentioned in this verse that one should take consideration of the time, place, and available conveniences. Prabhupada says our movement is going on all over the world. We have deities everywhere. And then he makes a very heavy statement. He says, sometimes our Indian friends, puffed up with concocted notions, criticize, this has not been done, that has not been done, but they forget this instruction of Narada Muni to one of the greatest Vaishnavas, Dhruva. One has to consider the particular time, country, and conveniences. What is convenient in India may not be convenient in the Western countries. So, Prabhupada says, the fact is that people that criticize some changes cannot do anything personally to spread Krishna consciousness. If someone does go and preach, taking all risks and allowing all considerations for time and place, it might be that there are changes in the manner of worship, but that is not at all faulty according to Shastra. So Prabhupada continues the same line of thinking in the next verse, because the next verse we get this list of paraphernalia, salilai, water, and shuchi. Shuchi, we know the word shuchi means clean or pure. And the word shuchi beer grammatically can refer to the entire list. And Prabhupada takes it that way. He says pure water, pure flower garlands, fruits, and so on. So grammatically in context here, Prabhupada is applying the word shuchi to this entire list of paraphernalia. So here's the list. Water, garland, flower garlands, specifically of wildflowers, forest flowers, vanyaya. And also the word vanya, like the word sushi, can refer to the other things. You can collect the other things in the forest too, such as water, mula. We collect in ISKCON, we tend to collect mula, but that's a little different. Here we have the mula mantra. Hey, where are you coming from? So, but this is actually the Sanskrit word. Anyway, for those of you listening in foreign countries, mula is English American slang for money. But here the word mula means root. So roots, like carrots. Aren't carrots roots? Radishes? And so on. So, I mean, there are roots that we eat. Phala, fruits, adibi, and shasta, newly grown grass, ankura, buds, angshuka, tree skins, tree bark, not my favorite salad ingredient. But you can use it for different things, maybe not for salad, but you can use it for, it's sort of the original organic clothing. And Tulas Yapra Yapra Boom, and Tulsi is mentioned as being dear, with dear Tulsi, one should worship the Lord. So, this is an interesting and somewhat controversial topic, which I will not get myself in trouble over today. But I think it's an interesting historical question that, for example, 1,000 years from now, what will our movement, literally, in the literal sense, look like in terms of how people will dress and how what kinds of foods they will offer and so on, what kind of architecture there will be. What we know that, for example, Christianity is spread all around the world and people don't dress in Palestinian robes and sandals, but of course then there's the idea that this kind of dress is somehow eternal. And it's interesting, Prabhupada said different things about it. As we know, there are different quotes from Prabhupada about our dress. Prabhupada said that the devotees look like they're from Vaikuntha when they're dressed this way. Prabhupada has also said, whoever said the devotees were important, I never said that, that was your idea. So if you look in the Veda base, you'll find Prabhupada making different statements about it. And of course, dress is also part of external paraphernalia. Ultimately, I think this is going to be decided not by any debate that we have at this time, but just history will go its own way. History will go its own way. And when we're dead and gone, devotees will get up in the morning and put on some clothes, and we won't be able to control that. So, and it gets into this tension. This, in a sense, it's a perennial tension. The ancient philosopher Heraclitus is apparently said that he gave the example of a bow. He said life is really in sort of in a state of tension. He gave the example of a bow. A bow is taut. In other words, the string is tight so that if you pull it back and let go, the arrow goes somewhere. The reason that the bowstring is tight or taut is because there's a tension. You curve a bow, you know, you take a stick or something, and you bend it. And because it's bent in that way, then you tie it with a string, there's a tension between the two ends of the bow. And it's actually that tension which keeps the string tight. Similarly, he said, there are tensions in this world. There is, for example, take in general, any serious spiritual movement must have two fundamental duties. One is to preserve. We have to preserve our spiritual inheritance. The other duty is to adapt. Because the world's very different now than it was 500 years ago or 5,000 years ago. Or than it was 40 years ago when Prabhupada sailed to this country. It's a very different country in many ways. And history shows that movements which do not in any way adapt, for example, we're now on the internet. We weren't on the internet when Prabhupada came because there wasn't an internet. Devotees now, for example, there was a period when devotees first started moving out of the temples and all they knew how to do was to go out in the street and sell something. So you had all these devotees living outside, private lives, with their families, going out in the street, claiming to be priests, and selling some, I don't know, candy or incense, claiming to be priests, and collecting money from the public, and the money was going simply to maintain their private lives and their families. Now we have a situation where many devotees are teaching yoga, which is obviously much more promising in terms of a way of infiltrating society and just and attracting people gradually to Krishna consciousness. So you can see all these changes in the movement. There are different changes, which are, of course, external. The basics can't change. The basics can't change, but it's... So there's a tension between this need to preserve and the need to adapt. And we have in ISKCON, as you have in any society, liberals who may be focusing more on adapting, and conservatives who want to conserve more. Let's just preserve what we have. And there's a tension between those two, between the liberal tendency and the conservative tendency. It's a tendency which you can observe in Prabhupada's own life. For example, at one point, Prabhupada's liberal side led him to form an In God We Trust political party. And at one point, it had center stage. Prabhupada used to talk about it. I took many walks with Prabhupada here in Los Angeles, and that was the main thing he was talking about. He was very, very enthusiastic about a political party. Then, when he saw certain tendencies, he stopped it, or at least said it can go on, but not as a formal part of ISKCON. It should be separate. So, again, the need to adapt, but the need to preserve a certain purity. So in Prabhupada's own life, with the political party, and in many other cases, you see Prabhupada, for example, at times saying, Hari Shori one told me that he went into Prabhupada's room and his hair, he hadn't shaved up like in 6 weeks or something. And Prabhupada shouted at him and said, these are your hippie seeds growing again. And then a year later, you find Prabhupada talking to Rameshwara in Los Angeles, is in the Veda base, giving permission for brahmacharis to grow their hair out a bit so they can go out and sell books. So this tension between preserving and adapting is visible in Prabhupada's own life. What to speak of, or not to speak of, as everybody else in the world says, what to speak of is ISKCON, and the rest of the world says not to speak of. Not to speak of the tension between different devotees. Some devotees are very much focused on conserving what we have. Let's just don't change anything. And the good old days can last forever. Some devotees are focused on adapting, making relevant, superficial, but relevant changes so we can penetrate society. And there's a tension, as there was in Prabhupada's own life and teachings. There's a tension between these devotees. And I would suggest that the solution is not to cut off one end of the bow. In other words, those who are focused more on adapting should not think that if all the conservatives would just go away, we could really get somewhere in life. And the conservatives should not falsely think that if all these people stop trying to adapt, and if you could just, you know, if we could just live in 1968 forever, that would solve everything. Or actually, more technically, maybe 1972. So, there's a tension. This tension is visible in the Bhagavatam, where Vyasadeva was trying to find a balance. And Narada came, his guru had to come and help him to find a balance between adapting and conserving. So, there will always be this tension. I would say that the day that there is no tension, ISKCON is in trouble. If everyone only wants to preserve and no one wants to adapt, I would say this movement is probably not going to be in a very dynamic situation. And if everyone wants to adapt and no one wants to preserve, we are in danger of becoming assimilated by the general society. So that's life. I think the problem, if there is a problem at all, is the notion that we can sort of go back in time when ISKCON was a very small society, very small, and everyone kind of thought the same way, and if anyone thought differently, then some authority would sit down with that person and give him the happy alternatives or thinking like everybody else, or moving out of the temple. And so we now find that we have a diverse society, and I am quite sure that this is an irreducible diversity. That does not mean that we live in chaos. It doesn't mean there's no law and order in ISKCON. There's no standards. To give an example from the Ramayana, when Lakshman finally gave in to Sita, who falsely thought that Ram was calling her, and ran off, he drew a line of protection for Sita, and Sita was safe within those boundaries. However, it's interesting to note in geometric terms that Lakshman did not give her a point to stand on. He didn't say, you have to stand on this point, and if you take one step in any direction, you'll be vulnerable. He gave her an area, a safe area, not a safe point. He didn't even give her a safe line. He gave her a safe area. And if we look at Prabhupada's instructions and find Prabhupada saying apparently different things on so many superficial things, not on the essential things, then the proper conclusion is not that Prabhupada contradicted himself. The proper conclusion is that Prabhupada, was, like Lakshmana for Sita, was drawing for the devotees a safe area, not merely a narrow line, although we know it's devotional service is a razor's edge, but in some ways a razor's edge, in some ways an area, a house in which everybody can live. Everyone can't live on the edge of a razor. So there are different metaphors, there are different images to convey different aspects of truth. And the fact is that Prabhupada drew a boundary. Within that boundary is an area. It's not simply a point. It's not even just a line. It's an area. It's two-dimensional. It's not one-dimensional. And within that area, we are safe. And there are liberal and conservative sides within that area. To think that Prabhupada... Well, I mean, otherwise, how could it be a house in which everyone can live? The idea that if we just, you know, waste more of our time on the internet, there are, I mean, some internet communication, I think, is actually useful in devotional service. There is a massive amount of internet communication among devotees, which I wonder about. Because nothing's ever resolved. So, despite, I mean, we can discuss for the end of, till the end of time, but there's going to be diversity in ISKCON, and Prabhupada made it that way. Prabhupada said it was impersonalism to think that everyone would be the same, and therefore he gave us an area and not simply a point to stand it on. And so it's a continual struggle. How can we adapt? How far can we go? Where is too far? Where is not enough? And devotees will, frankly, have to face this challenge in every generation because the world is changing. And therefore, this is going to be a continuous process of adapting. It's like if you're flying a plane, the pilot has to adapt. Suddenly there's turbulence, or there's another plane that's not supposed to be there. That's the nature of flying. You have to constantly respond to changing circumstances, changing weather. And the cultural weather of the world is constantly changing. There are unexpected storms, and sometimes there's all kinds of things. Krishna says the world is endlessly mutable. So we have an unchanging core of knowledge and practices, but in more superficial things, we have to constantly adapt to an ever-changing, Krishna says, endlessly mutable world. We can't lose our unchanging core, and we can't stop responding to the changing historical and cultural weather. And therefore, you've got to do two things. And this is the creative, this is the art. If it was just mechanical, you just do the same thing forever, how would it be an art? It's the art of all work, Krishna says in the Gita. It's an art and a science. And if we are serious to spread this movement, we've got to become devotional artists in that sense. And really, and this comes from realization. Prabhupada says that discrimination comes from realization. Anyway, this is Krishna consciousness. So any questions on these points? Yes, we're going to pass the microphone. We have a talk show format. Here, Vanabhata here.
Maharaj, I hope I'm not deviating too much from your very thought provocative class.
But you want to ask about the newly grown grass.
What about that grass? No. in your opinion, what's the purpose and the importance of Ishtagosti?
Ishtagosti is extremely important. I looked on the Veda base under Ishtagosti and found that Prabhupada talked about it during his entire mission. He began talking about it when he first came to this country. and he was talking about it up till the end. And Prabhupada assumed that temples were having yasagosti every week. He assumed that devotees were sitting down and talking to each other. He assumed that was going on. And I think the importance of it, I mean, it should be obvious. That people that live and work together should sit down and talk to each other as a community. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. Usually I don't ask questions. But as we see the, just a comment on what you were saying about changes, the forefathers of our land drew up the Constitution, and had they known that attorneys that we have nowadays would be interpreting each word, then they would have put a clause in there stating morality. We see now there is no morals when you go into the courtroom. It's all about the letter of the law. So saying that, I would think that Srila Prabhupada, if we want to become so diverse, he would have put certain stipulations there. But that's just my comment. My question is...
He would have, what kind of stipulation are you referring to?
Well, I know one example is that when the six devotees went to London...
Well, excuse me for interrupting you. What about this stipulation here in this purport where Prabhupada says, if someone does go and preach, taking all risks and allowing all considerations for time and place, that is not at faulty. I mean, that sounds to me like a mandate to adapt.
Yes, and so therefore, when devotees went to London to push on Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada was inspired that his devotees would not adapt like other sannyasis had from the Gaudiya Math, that they would actually be dressed in Vaishnava attire and they would be chanting Hare Krishna on the street.
Prabhupada was equally inspired when his disciples did adapt and did change their dress and sold lots of books. He thought that he found that at least equally inspiring. One interesting point is that the very notion of Vaishnava attire, devotional dress, is very interesting because it's a term which is not found in the Bhagavatam. For example, I'm wearing sannyas, well, even though I'm dressed, I have to admit I'm wearing a sannyas dress. But we have pictures of Lord Chaitanya, I'm sure, somewhere in this temple, certainly on the covers of our books, on many altars around the world, where Lord Chaitanya is not dressed exactly like this. Prabhupada said to me, personally, in Vrindavan one time, that he said to me, if you want to understand sannyas, you should study the six Goswamis. They are the ideal sannyasis. And we know, we have evidence from the song of the six Goswamis, they didn't dress like this. Their dress is described as kopina kantashrito. They wore kopins and rags. So, for example, we call sannyasis Maharaj. Prabhupada called his guru Maharaj. You won't find that in any scripture. That's a fairly recent Hindu custom. You won't find any scripture where anyone calls a sannyasi Maharaj. Now, even Lord Chaitanya himself followed certain customs, Hindu customs, because you can't, you know, just change everything or overthrow everything. But sometimes there are adjustments. For example, Prabhupada was criticized very much by people in India, sort of old fogies, for changing lots of things. And Prabhupada one time responded to that criticism to me personally. We were walking on the roof in Mayapur, and he said, some people criticize because Lord Chaitanya walked around India, but I don't walk, I take the jet plane. He said, so should I be a fool and rascal and imitate Chaitanya Mahaprabhu? Now, I don't find any evidence in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that when Lord Chaitanya was in Navadvip, that when people joined his movement, they changed their dress. I don't find any evidence that when the Sankirtan party went out, the Harinam party, Lord Chaitanya's own Harinam party, that they were dressed differently than everybody else in the city. And we know from the scriptures that was not a Vaishnav community. It was a very degraded, fallen place. So much so that Advaitacharya was tempted to destroy the universe. So I think we need to, Prabhupada said, apply all of your intelligence to understanding things. And so I'm not, I'm simply trying to understand. I think it's healthy sometimes for us to try to understand these things and discuss them. Again, if Prabhupada said, I'm very happy the devotees in London didn't change their dress, and he defended the fact that thousands of other devotees were changing their dress for preaching, and he was very happy about it, that in 1975 or 76 told Rameshwara that yes, I mean, he authorized it many times, the devotees could even grow their hair somewhat, even the brahmacharis. That's right. So, again, if you look at all of what Prabhupada said, not just pick out your favorite quote and hit someone over the head with it, but if you look at all of what Prabhupada said, we have not a point, but an area. We have an area defined by all of Prabhupada's instructions. And we are protected within that area. That's the point I'm trying to make. Yes, Prahlada Nandaswamy?
As you're constantly referring back to Srila Prabhupada, so Srila Prabhupada was the acharya when he was, as he was present here. And in his absence, although he defined many different, an area, as you said, but he was the one who was defining it according to time, place, and the particular audience.
Not always.
Well, whatever.
I'll give you an example of not always.
Not sometimes, or usually.
I can give you a practical example of how that's what you're saying is not always true. Prabhupada, when he was here, he gave a very strict order that the Bhagavatam had to be published hardbound. He didn't want it, in fact, he said he didn't want it published as a softbound book, as it previously done. He wanted it published as a hardbound book. Prabhupada put me in charge of Spanish BBT, and I published the Bhagavatam softbound because that was practical where I was preaching. And I wrote to Prabhupada to inform him. He said, yeah, sure, it's a great idea. Do whatever is practical. So Prabhupada, I'm not sure that's true, that Prabhupada, that there can be no adapting. That all the, to me, it's almost like a Ritwik adapting philosophy.
What I'm saying is not that there's no adapting. Of course, yes, there has to be adapting. I agree with you. There's tension, and there's liberals, there's a conservative. Of course, that has to be there. But someone has to be the authority to decide when we're liberal and when we're a conservative. So there has to be, Prabhupada was the acharya when he was here. He decided what was good, what was not good, what was adaptable.
Prabhupada never claimed that he had given an exhaustive, complete
I'm not disagreeing with that, but I'm saying that in his absence,
yes,
there also has to be an authority or authorities,
yes,
who has to decide in the midst of the discussion what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. Not that each one of us becomes an independent authority, and within our little realm of experience, we decide what's good for us and what's not.
Actually, to a certain extent, each one of us is an independent authority. For example, when we send devotees out on Sankirtan, you can't just give them a little manual. If the non-devotee says this, you say that. So that every time the non-devotee says something, he's got to punch into a computer, look up in a manual.
Yes, I agree with that.
But let me just finish this. There is a balance between following authority and being yourself.
And
those two have to be balanced. Every one of us, I could explain how every one of them in this room, certainly including myself, does their own thing. And I could show you how everyone in this room, including myself, doesn't follow to the letter every detailed thing that Prabhupada ever said.
Again, my point is that even though there is independence and there is also authority, the authority is supervising authority, and ultimately we have higher and higher authorities, and what's called the acharya is ultimately the authority which decides which is good and which is not good, which could be supervised, which has to be supervised, which is not supervised.
That is true, and fortunately, we have a founder acharya who was so enlightened about human and spiritual affairs that he gave us a set of instructions which are flexible and which allow space for people to breathe, yeah, and to be individual. I'm not questioning for a moment. I'm a member of ISKCON. Prabhupada is the ultimate authority. But I see, but it gets into the interpretation of Prabhupada. Some people interpret Prabhupada as someone that wanted to micromanage to the smallest detail every aspect of our lives. I personally don't think that was the real Prabhupada. I think the real Prabhupada, as I knew him, or as I understand him from my perspective, the real Prabhupada gave us very powerful, unchanging basic principles, practices, teachings, and also created ample space for individual expression, for individual inspiration, and because he knew that not only was the soul individual in general, but he knew specifically, and he talks about this, that in the Western countries, people are very much used to having a certain amount of freedom. Now, anything can go too far. Freedom can go so far, it becomes chaos and anarchy and it just and mob rule. That's not what we mean by freedom. There has to be authority, there has to be law and order, there have to be standards. But at the same time, there has to be a balance between the needs of the society to have order and standards and authority, and the needs of the individual to have a certain amount of freedom and individuality. And those two have to be balanced.
Okay.
That's my simple point. I'm not an anarchist, but I'm not...
I think you take any topic... Everyone's going to have their point of view, and that point of view may, as you pointed out, is even changeable under different time places.
Not every topic. For example, Krishna is to Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the original form of the Godhead. That's not changeable within ISKCON. Yeah, but also I think I can conduct this discussion even without your help. Thank you. Thank you, Govinda.
So, in the midst of, we may have our particular idea about some particular point. I'm not discussing absolute knowledge. I'm discussing what you're pointing out, the relative aspects of living in a society which is changing according to time, place, in a society which is changing according to time, place, and circumstance. But in the midst of that, we have our methodology that Prabhupada has also given us, in order to decide, I mean, it's an eternal principle that, yes, we can have our feelings, we can have our opinions, we can have our realizations, but ultimately we just have to work together and do it in the best possible way to distribute Krishna consciousness. Mm-hmm. So.
But the best possible way, according to Prabhupada, is a situation where there's that balance. So I don't think, in other words, ultimately, there's freedom. Prabhupada explains this very clearly in the first canto of the Bhagavatam, where he says, freedom... Is there a first canto here? Is there... It's first canto, chapter 6, I think the last or second to last verse. Yes. First canto, chapter 6, where Prabhupada says that the essence of devotional service is freedom. And so, of course, one can exercise freedom appropriately to the extent that one is responsible and Krishna conscious. And I agree with you. We're not disagreeing. There has to be an ultimate managing authority. That's the very first point in Prabhupada's will, that there must be an ultimate managing authority for ISKCON. However, in order to manage effectively, a managing authority has to allow an appropriate amount, not too much and not too little, an appropriate amount of freedom. And that's one of the essential qualities of good management.
Can't disagree with that. Whether or not they're doing it or what particulars feel, that we can always discuss.
What's that?
In other words, whether or not they're allowing... Whether the temple president, whether the GBC, whether the guru, whether my temple commander is allowing me an appropriate amount of freedom in some particular aspect of devotional service that I'm concerned with, that can always be discussed.
And there are different individuals. I mean, some leaders exercise more control, some exercise less. Some leaders are concerned about controlling a certain area, others are concerned about another area. Some leaders are liberal, some are conservative. There is a tremendous, within the boundaries given by Prabhupada, there is a tremendous diversity in this movement.
But ultimately, I think we both agree that whatever our authorities, whoever they may be, then we follow them, ultimately.
If we choose to work under a particular authority, as they say, lead, follower, get out of the way. So if a devotee chooses to work in a particular place under a particular authority, yes, and that devotee should cooperate. I think it's contradictory to decide, as an adult, to make a decision, I'm going to work in this place where there's this authority, but I'm not going to follow the system there. As they say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So therefore, people, you know, every devotee as an adult and as a Vaishnav has to find a devotional service where that person can work peacefully and effectively. Yes, Archita? Could you bring it up here for a second? Is that possible? Does your battery work? And Savas, did you want to speak? Microphone? Is the microphone there?
I would say that the last comment out of all the things made more sense to me than anything, first of all. But secondly, I'd say that, you know, in Krishna consciousness, yes, you're right. There's always going to be that liberal and conservative argument. But, personally, I think, in my opinion, as an authority, so-called authority in Los Angeles, and in order for I don't have a big brain. My brain's very small. And I can't pack too many things in it. And because my brain is very small and I can't pack too many things in it, we work in a particular way here. And so can we criticize that? In other words, if I go to Denver, or can I criticize Nikatma? Or if I go to Laguna Beach, can I criticize that person's activities, that they're not liberal or they're too conservative? Do we really know who they are and how they work? Do we really spend the time and the energy to find out their feelings or their understandings? In other words, I think in order to come to that particular conclusion, in certain respects, it probably takes, we should take a little time to understand the person. If we try to understand Srila Prabhupada, that's very difficult. I can't sit here and say that I know or I'm going to interpret what Srila Prabhupada has said, but I can get a pretty good idea what he wants by different things that I've read in the book. Somebody else could be right next to me reading the same passage and having a whole complete different understanding. But you know, we can be friends, but they have a whole different understanding. Like sometimes in a conversation I can have with someone else think that Srila Prabhupada was very tough. I thought he was very strong, a great leader, at no matter what level or capacity of anxiety, he could handle it. And that's what attracted me to Srila Prabhupada, whereas someone right next to me thought that Prabhupada was like loving, caring, really liberal and all abounding, loving abode. Whereas in other devotees I've heard that Prabhupada was so intense and so heavy that they just couldn't handle it. I think that we're discussing an issue here that needs a lot of thought and a lot of introspection and a lot of maturity in Krishna consciousness, which I don't feel I have. I'm looking around the room here, and I'm also feeling that about other devotees. I don't think they have this kind of understanding that you're trying to profess in a Srimad Bhagavatam class. I think it more appropriate to be in a room with Istagosi, as you are saying. But I don't know if this is something that should be discussed in the Srimad Bhagavatam class about conservative and liberal and who understands what. Because this is called a lot of confusion. I mean, in the Srimad Bhagavatam class, when I read about Parikshit Maharaj, he was talking about the philosophy. He wasn't talking about liberalism, conservatism. He was talking about go back home, back to Godhead. And you can do that by certain processes.
Well, to be fair here, I want to respond to a few things you said. First of all, Prabhupada, in his Bhagavatam purport, talks about liberals and conservatives. He doesn't use that language. That's not Prabhupada's language. But he's talking about some people criticize certain things. But
Prabhupada also said that there's a lot of karmis in devotee dress in this movement.
Yeah.
That's a direct quote in the Bhagavatam purport. There's a lot of karmis in the dress of devotees, of Vaishnava, in Krishna consciousness. So does that mean that all of a sudden I think there's a lot of karmis everywhere in this movement, and I'm looking in this temple?
Well, no,
do I make a decision that someone's a karmi, but they're just, they have Vaishnava dress on? But no, I think that they're a karmi.
Well, I'm making a different point. I'm just.
Well, it's in the same line. We're actually trying to profess that one should think about what you are. Are you a conservative or are you a liberal?
No, not at all. I'm not telling you.
Well, people are taking it that way, I can assure you. I can assure you that the way the comment has come.
Okay, first of all, I did make clear.
I think you made the other point clear also.
Yeah.
I mean, whatever point you made clear, you also
I made clear that I think that both are needed. I didn't say, in fact, I said it would be dangerous if we didn't have people, a variety in ISKCON. So I don't think that can be interpreted as saying everybody should be the same way. I said actually everyone shouldn't be the same way. And therefore it's not really a call to everyone to be this way or that way. Also, Prabhupada directly addresses the topic of preserving versus adapting in his purport. In fact, he calls some people foolish. He talks about some people criticize, but it's a foolish criticism. So this is not just talking about purely philosophical topics. Prabhupada is directly addressing this. In fact, the Bhagavatam itself addresses it.
I don't remember that in the purport, though. Maybe maybe the purport in today,
I read it today. I can read it again.
I don't remember about conservatives or liberal, and I don't remember about...
Prabhupada doesn't use that language, but he says sometimes our Indian friends puffed up with concocted notions criticize. This has not been done, that has not been done, but they forget that one has to consider the whole purport. This whole section of the Bhagavatam is about the need to adapt to time and place. That's what the whole topic is here.
Yeah, but then Prabhupada also says that if we actually walked around naked and stood on our heads, that everybody would like that. So does that mean that we go and walk around with our naked bodies and walk on our head?
Well, that would be taking it to an absurd extreme.
Okay.
And if I say, for example... That I could say, for example, that if you eat 50 pounds of broccoli today, you'll die. And therefore, the conclusion is, well, therefore, don't eat broccoli. In other words, taking something all the way to an absurd extreme doesn't mean that that same tendency...
But that's not absurd, because when he said that, at that time, streaking was very popular.
Very streaking.
Yeah, streaking. In 1974, 1975, and this era, that was a streaking era. People would disrobe themselves and run naked.
Right.
In all kinds of different circumstances. So Prabhupada, I'm sure, made that statement because he knew or he heard that this activity was going on.
No,
and
of course.
A lot of people liked it.
Of course, but what I mean, I used words like within reasonable boundaries. I made the point many, many times in this class that it's Prabhupada himself who drew the boundaries. And I made very clear in the class that you can't do whatever you want, but rather you can do what you want within the boundaries that Prabhupada himself has established. I gave the example of Lakshman drawing. It's not that Sita could go anywhere. She had to stay within the boundaries. So I think I've made that point many, many times in the class.
Thank you. You did that. Especially in the end there, yes. I agree.
I think there is if I can be perfectly honest, I think there's a tendency that if someone, let's say in a Bhagavatam class, says something which is sort of not like what everybody else says, it's like a 12 alarm fire or something. But if you actually looked at a transcript of what I said, I think it's not that radical. Another point I wanted to address is that you made, as far as taking the time to understand someone. And I hope this is a Bhagavatam topic, but I think in a healthy spiritual society, there should be let's talk about Prabhupada. Again, I'll refer back to Prabhupada. In December of 1973, Prabhupada wrote a letter to a disciple, I think it was Akirtananda actually, announcing or informing him that in a few months, Prabhupada was convoking the first annual Mayapur GBC meeting. That Prabhupada wanted to have an international Mayapur festival. The first one was 1974, and he wanted to have an official GBC meeting at that Mayapur, at that international festival. Prabhupada was just creating that custom. And it's very interesting, in that letter, Prabhupada said that the GBC and other senior devotees should meet and discuss together. In other words, even though the GBC was the ultimate managing authority, Prabhupada's vision of a meaningful meeting was that there would be the GBC and other senior devotees. And, of course, we have that custom now. At the meetings are held at least, well, twice a year, New Vrindavan and Dallas. And so you can't see the forest for the trees sometimes, but also you have to see the trees. And so there is an inevitable fact in the world that if you're right on the ground doing something, you know more than anyone all the details of what's going on. But someone who's standing outside at a distance will have a perspective that I won't have if I'm right in the middle of everything. And so therefore, in order to get, you know, it's like in a football game. They got one coach right on the sideline, someone up in the press box with binoculars. And so it seems to me, it seems obvious that in order to get the best possible perspective on how to do things in Krishna consciousness, we need people who are on the ground, who are actually doing the work, rolling up their sleeves. And we also need people who are outside observing. And of course, not in an oppressive, arrogant way, but just, and there should be a healthy dialogue going on between people who are in the middle of things and people who are up in the press box.
I agree.
And that both sides have to take the time to get to know each other.
I agree. That's correct. I totally agree with that. Thank you.
Should I read this from Prabhupada at the end? Whoops. Well, maybe I won't read it because the computer's gone. The what? I'll end with a quote from Prabhupada. Oh. Prabhupada, this is a purport to 1637. And again, this is not a call to anarchy and libertarianism or streaking. It said that after Narada finished his discussion with Vyas, it said that he left, and he's described as Yadrachi Komuni. He was a sage, he was a free sage. Prabhupada says, every living being is anxious for full freedom because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through the transcendental service of the Lord. And then Prabhupada talks about false freedom through material life. And then he says, at the end of his purport, that therefore, in all spheres of devotional service, freedom is the main pivot. Without freedom, there is no execution of devotional service. The freedom surrendered to the Lord does not mean that the devotee becomes dependent in every respect. To surrender unto the Lord through the transparent medium of the spiritual master is to attain complete freedom of life. I mean, so obviously, the more you follow the doctor, the more healthy you get, the more you can be free. So the freedom is based on surrender and obedience. But ultimately, there is this desire for freedom within reasonable boundaries and at the feet of Krishna. So perhaps, Govinda, you wanted to...
About shaved head and tilak and kunti mala and our dress, changing our dress, because Prabhupada wanted to create a section of brahmanas and leaders of society. So when we preach to this high standard, I think automatically, because of course we need that standard for maintaining the deity worship, for the prasadam distribution, for the Hari Nam, for the book distribution, but automatically these other things will come because there will always be people who don't want to come to that high standard.
Prabhupada thought that his disciples who were
on the sidelines.
Prabhupada thought that his disciples were selling books, not visibly with all the Vaishnava markings, were serving him at the highest standard. So anyway, we have to look at all of Prabhupada's instructions, and we'll have to keep looking another day. Hare Krishna.